the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, Senior Editor at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined by a special guest today, who is Charlotte Powers, Digital Lead at Seven Stars. Hello to you, Charlotte.
Hi there, good morning.
Good morning, lovely to have you on with us. And also joining us is Anne-Marie Sheedy, Global Partnerships Director at ExchangeWire. Hello to you, Anne-Marie.
Hello, good morning and Happy New Year to everybody.
Happy New Year. It's sun is actually out in London, which is a rare thing.
I know, it's terrible. I've had to close the curtains because it's blinding me.
proper vampiric start to January. Diving into the first news story of the week, the New York Times has acquired the subscription sports publication The Athletic in an all-cash deal worth $550 million. The purchase will bolster the newspaper's digital presence and put it in a position to be a global leader in sports journalism, according to its CEO, Meredith Kopit-Levine. The deal reflects the publication's intention to become subscription-first, an increasingly common trend among media companies as print readership and advertising revenue continues to fall. The companies say that they have gained an additional 8 million paid subscribers across both print and digital products over the past 3 years and hope that acquiring The Athletic will help them extend this to 10 million. The Athletic, which was founded in 2016, covers updates from 200 sports teams and clubs globally and ended last year with a subscriber base of 1.2 million. The publication will continue to operate as an individual entity under the New York Times, with founders Alex Mather and Adam Hansman staying in place until the deal is complete. My first question to you guys is, how significant could this deal be for the New York Times? Charlotte, let's go to you first on that one.
Yeah, I think this is pretty significant for New York Times, actually. I think when you look at what The Athletic have built over, you know, the last 5 or 6 years of operation, they've got some really strong subscription numbers and a really strong subscription model, which I think will only bolster what is currently in place over at the New York Times. I was reading a couple of articles yesterday about, you know, The Athletic's model and their approach, and, you know, they've gone in quite aggressively, or some might say confidently, with how they want to grow their product and their offering to subscribers. So that, you know, they've said they're going to take the best talent from everywhere they can, which obviously puts them in a really brilliant position, and you can see why that is so appealing to the New York Times. And when you look at kind of how users are subscribing to platforms and publishers, generally you do only look at one or two subscriptions. So this will put the New York Times in a great position and kind of take those learnings that The Athletic have built over time to be able to enhance their own subscription model.
Anne-Marie, what are your thoughts on this one?
I agree. I think there's a lot of burnout, right, from the kind of intensity of the news agenda that we've had to endure for the past couple of years. So for them to kind of go all in into what's more of a passion point, where you've got an audience that's dedicated and really interested and follows, you know, the 200 sports and so forth that they've got on, I think it's a really smart move. Because one part, in terms of growing their revenue overall, journalism needs to take a breath in a way, because it's just, I think we need to focus on the basics and kind of come back with a little bit more enthusiasm, and I think we'll bounce back stronger. But that coupled with globally, there's been loads of, you know, many parts, revenues have been falling from a news media perspective. So for them to kind of go into this dedicated sports area, I think is super smart. And charging for news or information is the kind of end destination for many organizations. But really, if you think about how the economic conditions might change this year, the next 2 or 3 years, it's a really great opportunity for them. It's really smart. I think it'll really kind of put them in a strong position. And what information they'll garner from this audience and that 1.2 million subs is going to be really interesting to see how that kind of comes into play and what they do with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I completely agree with both of you there. I think it is a very sharp deal for New York Times. And I think a lot of press attention has been made about how you know, the sports broadcasting industry is set to undergo a huge boost in the coming years, and you've got rumors of the likes of Facebook, Amazon, Apple looking to buy up sports rights. But there hasn't been that much attention in terms of the analysis and print journalism around sports. So I think that could also be, you know, it could have a knock on effect on that industry. And I think now's probably the right time for companies to be acquiring, you know, sports-based publications. Looking towards, you know, the sort of wider media industry, what does it tell us about the state of the industry at the moment? And do we think more acquisitions will be coming in the space in the future? Charlotte?
Yeah, I think, you know, subscriptions are not something consumers, it's not something new for consumers. You know, we subscribe to newspapers, we subscribe to magazines, albeit that is dwindling. But you think of online subscription services, Prime, Netflix, Hey You, which is one of my personal favourites. But, you know, if we want to see and read content that interests us and engages us, we're willing to pay for it. So I don't think it's going to produce a short, sharp shift in the industry. But I do think online publishers are going to actually look at this approach and see, how can we drive standout? How can we become the winner of a consumer's time and attention and their cash ultimately? And what change does this have on business models as we move forward? You know, there are already a number of newspapers who are behind paywalls, and they have obviously smaller audiences than an open publisher, but those audiences are really engaged. And if they want to read that content, they are willing to pay for it. And so I think this is just something that we are, as consumers and the industry, are going to have to kind of adapt to and get used to. And it's something as us as agencies are going to have to start to tie into our strategies and think about how we therefore start planning our clients' campaigns with an increasing number of subscription publishers within the market.
Yeah, that's true. I think your point about subscription, you pay for what you want, and I'm guessing, Hey You, you're a fan of Below Deck. Not that I would know.
Absolutely.
That,
but yeah.
We all need some mind-numbing entertainment. But the reality is not every publisher is going to thrive, right? So there will be acquisitions, and those acquisitions will come as, you know, tighter privacy rules limiting third-party data come into play, along with the concerns that we as individuals have about misinformation. So we're going to want to go to more trusted places. And if we can get that information from a news perspective or an audio or sports, I think we'll be willing to pay for it. But there will be a cap on that, but that cap will probably be substituted, or at least there'll be the kind of the advertising will remain relatively competitive in those environments, because I think brands will be willing to pay a premium for that audience. It might be a smaller audience, but like you said, Charlotte, it's, you know, it's a dedicated audience. They know more about them. They can provide them with more relevant information to keep them engaged, rather than filling slots with retargeting that annoys us as individuals. But that's the kind of value exchange for an open source, where we want to read something there and then. But do we? We'll shift. If there's a paywall, I'll go on to another source. But will the information be as credible? And that's where I think they're going to open up a really interesting business model in terms of the information that they have and what products and services that they're going to roll out of that. And also what you were talking about, audio, for example. I mean, if you look at China, I think the subscription for audio streaming revenues out there are just on the rise rapidly. And they overtook ad-supported audio recently, but that's to do with, you know, the policies of the bigger streaming services and the right holders. And that's going to be interesting from the sports perspective as well, what they're going to be able to do above and beyond the subs that they've already got. How's that going to evolve is what I'm kind of really interested in seeing. And then, as to your point, Matt, as well, who else is going to follow down that route? Who else has got the bank balance that can pay in cash like they did? That would be interesting to see, and in which kind of regions as well that will play out in.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it will be really interesting to see how it evolves, because I think a lot of the kind of public market activity for media in terms of IPOs, I think that's cooled down a little bit. I think sort of off the top of my head, the BuzzFeed public listing via an SPAC, I think that's probably cooled a little bit of that, but I think there's still plenty of cash around for acquisitions. And yeah, like I say, it'll be interesting to see who gets bought up. Coming back to your point in terms of consumers don't have the kind of appetite to shell out loads of subscriptions, and you know, getting new source from alternative sources. Do you think we're heading towards an era where premium publishers become all kind of subscription based, or will there still be one or two premium publishers which have a more open model?
I don't think we'll get to a stage where the majority of premium content is behind a paywall, because, as I said, I'm only willing to pay for one or two or two or three subscription models for the content that I really want to consume. I think if you shift everything from being free to the public to behind a paywall, your reach and your users are going to drop significantly, because, as Amory said, if I don't find that article, if I don't want to pay to read that article, I can go onto Twitter and find it somewhere else. And yes, it might not be as credible, but I can still get the gist of what the article is saying through another source. So I think there's kind of a two-prong kind of approach, in my opinion. One is that bigger publishers will start to acquire, and this isn't, this isn't new news, will start to acquire smaller publishers to build their credentials, to build their reach, and to kind of take on more of a market share within their sector. But also it's about taking on, the big dogs, the likes of Meta and Google. And whilst what they're trying to deliver isn't the same, it's all about share of voice at the end of the day. So I think there will be an element of more acquisitions happening within the market purely to grow share of audiences and to grow engagement and audience reach.
Amory, anything to add on that final point?
No, I just sometimes feel that we're in a bubble, and I think it's looking at the different regions and marketplaces that's going to make a difference. Because me, having the luxury of having a steady income and, living in and around London versus someone that perhaps might be in a more remote area of the country and financially be in a different place, what's their viewpoint, and who are we trying to reach? Who are these organizations? What kind of subscription persona do they want to build? And the real point is the recurring revenue, and how will that be maintained for those that are not UK based? And I think it's relevant for Europe, but the biggest thing coming up on a personal basis is what's going to happen in the energy world. Our price increases are going to go up by 51%. How's that going to impact my behavior? Am I going to kind of think about what devices I've got on, how I'm consuming them, what I'm consuming, even down to the dwell time of something loading? Will I kind of stop going onto shittier websites for content when I've got to put up with all the crap ads on there that affects my experience? I know it's a bit random, but I do think these are going to come into play. And you look at, demographically, that's going to have an impact on what people are doing. It's all consequential, really. And it is one of those only time will tell type things. And that's why I'm particularly interested to see how this will kind of unfold as the months go by.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it will be hugely interesting to see how it all pans out. Moving to our second news story of the week, issues associated with cross-platform integrated measurement will continue to act as a driving force for change for media buying and selling organizations. That's according to a survey carried out by MediaOcean, which determined that 60% of executives believe that improvements in integrated media execution will be the most impactful, while 57% say that measurement improvement on non-cookie methods will generate the biggest changes to business. Those surveyed also anticipate that shifts will be powered by the convergence of TV measurement and planning and the growth of emerging channels such as VR and immersive gaming. Changes are also expected to come thanks to enhanced contextual targeting, improved first-party data infrastructure, and the implementation of AI and machine learning. Many respondents indicated that they plan to divert more ad spend to CTV, with over 70% stating that they plan to increase investment by up to one-fifth. However, 46% indicated concern over reach and frequency across CTV, as well as with continuing concern surrounding the levels of ad fraud within the channel. My first question to you guys is, are you surprised by the findings in this survey, and how reflective do you think the survey is of the industry at large? Amory, let's start off with you.
Oh my goodness. I mean, Charlotte's probably a lot more experienced on this, but I'll give it a shot. I do like a good research report. I do find it interesting, but I have to ask the question, this is a global report, but what's the weighting of this report, especially when you look at the kind of CTV elements and where people are going to invest. It's very fragmented in different markets. And for them to say that 70% of people are going to increase it by a fifth, what does that actually mean? How do those numbers break down? And what's the opportunity? It's looking at the measurement piece and the reach and frequency. I just feel that a lot of change needs to happen. We need to kind of focus on more goal-orientated metrics rather than kind of the proxy measures, the clicks or the reach campaigns that we were traditionally looking at. What does that measurement piece look like? How is it unified, in different markets on different channels? Because there's the fragmentation across kind of closed platforms and walled gardens is really going to add to this, the challenge of insightful measurements, in my opinion. And then you build on top of that the lack of clear alternatives to the measurement capabilities of third party data that could lead brands to kind of maybe change their approach. Maybe they're not going to be willing to risk their spends, which could have a negative impact on the industry overall. But then you'll have some people that perhaps would say, well, we need to see how kind of universal IDs are going to work, and these privacy first solutions, they could open up new possibilities for cross device measurement, including, whether it's desktop or smartphones or CTV. It's just, I find it baffling. I think it's brilliant that they've done a report they're trying to uncover, but I just think we need to dig a little bit deeper. Maybe I didn't kind of go into the report in enough detail to kind of get that clarification, but there's just so many questions around it. And that's why I'm sure I'm really, clear on a day-to-day. How in God's name do you guys manage this? How do you have the conversations with clients around this? It must be keeping you up at night.
Could say that. Yeah, first of all, I completely agree. I think the findings are very broad and cover so many elements of media and of campaign delivery. And, cross-channel media buying in itself is such a complicated area of media planning. And as an agency, we try and we are and have been over the last 18 months moving towards looking at a campaign as a whole without siloing channels. So, a lot of agencies, and I'm so guilty of doing this, you'll sit in a room with a client or you'll be on a call and you'll have each person from each channel coming and presenting their channel. So you'll have your digital specialist talking about display and video. You'll have your social specialist talking about Facebook. You'll bring the AV specialist in to talk about linear TV. And whilst you know that this plan has been built on having these conversations and working together on a proposal, I think outward facing, it can look like we're still treating these channels as silos. So in order to measure cross-platform performance really effectively, we need to dig a bit deeper into, well, what does that look like as a plan on plan on a page? Like, how do we demonstrate that we're delivering a cross-platform plan without having a TV plan standing on its own, a digital plan standing on its own? And you can, of course, back that up with your rationale and your strategy. But I think when it comes to delivery, there's still a bit of work to be done in how you kind of tick all those boxes and make all of that activity work together. And then ultimately, on the flip side, once the campaign has delivered or is delivering, you need to make sure all your measurement is aligned. And each of those channels are measured using different tools, different platforms, different KPIs, different objectives, and obviously factoring in emerging platforms like podcasts and, as you said, Matt, connected TV. These are still relatively new to the industry, and we're still working and looking into how these run for a brand, what they deliver, how we're measuring them, and, as you said, how we're combating ad fraud. So it's making sure, actually, when you come to the measurement side, all of your measurement platforms are working holistically. They're all measuring the same thing. And ultimately, your media plan is delivering against each of those KPIs to deliver that kind of final stat that you need to take to clients and take back to brands.
If you add on top of that, the kind of the metaverse, the virtual or semi-virtual worlds, is that even a conversation on the table now? Because that's just surely going to add even more complexity.
Yeah, it's kind of that dark cloud hanging over us.
Or can you just make it up for the moment because it's so new?
But isn't it all made up, really? So the meta is made up. I think...
What, point three, is it?
Green. yeah, I think it's a really interesting space because I don't feel like we know enough about it yet. I think we've kind of been teased into what it is and what it's going to become, but it's so subjective and it's what you want it to be. You can make the metaverse what you want for your needs. So I think it's definitely an interesting area of conversation to be having with Meta themselves, but also what does this mean for the other big players like Google? How are they going to bring that into their future plans and their future models? And of course, online publishers, what does it mean for them? How are they interpreting what the metaverse will look like in 6 months, a year, 5 years' time? I think it's still an area that needs a lot of attention and a lot of interpreting for us to be able to take forward ideas to our clients and see how we can use it in our future media planning.
Absolutely agree. And I think, like you say, that model hasn't been developed enough to the point that you can go, you know, this is the point we can measure against. It's just not there at the moment. But speaking on that kind of infrastructure point, there was quite a low proportion of respondents within the survey, only 28%, indicating that changes to first-party data infrastructure will drive changes to media planning and buying. And that I found personally, I found that quite surprising. Are you guys quite surprised by that finding?
Again, this is where it lacks kind of detail or clarity for me because it's global. And who are they talking to? And which segment of the research have they kind of drawn upon for this particular stat? Because you'll have perhaps agencies that are quite confident and they know what they're doing. Brands may not be so confident and they might be relying on their agencies. I think initially there was a lot of people that it was very front of mind. And then when it's been pushed back, it's kind of going, oh, okay, well, we've got other priorities now, so it'll be fine. It'll happen when it happens. And there's so many solutions, in inverted commas, out there that are they actually clear which is the right one for them and what will it deliver? Because those solutions haven't actually needed to demonstrate any results yet because they haven't been needed. So there's just a huge question mark around it for me.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's the use of first party data and having that data within a business is just so kind of bread and butter. And when we were preparing for Chrome to be removing third party cookies, it was kind of all hands on deck in looking at solutions to that. So brands and advertisers were kind of happy with what was happening with their first party data strategy. And it was kind of the starting bed for their campaigns and their activity. I think that, as I said, the kind of what was going to be the removal of third-party cookies last year kind of shifted everyone's attention into new solutions, new tech, new opportunities. So, I think we can question the sample here in terms of who have we asked this question to, and it is a relatively low sample number. I think on the report it's just about 250 people. So I think actually if this was a much bigger survey, we'd probably see a shift in those results, mainly because of how fragmented we are in digital advertising. We would see those percentages change depending on who it was we were asking and the number of people we were asking. But I've gone a bit of a roundabout way on that point.
No, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. It's who, because, yeah, you know, who within the agency, who within the publisher, who within the brand? Because if it's not, you know, your day-to-day job, if you're going to be smacked with the fine for breaches, you know, it's not going to be front of mind for you. It's going to be lower down your priority. That's just natural.
Yeah. And if you're asking, you know, MDs and CEOs, they're not going to know for every single brand within their agency what their first-party data strategy is. So if you're asking the planners, they'll certainly know. So it would be interesting to see if this research was run again, how it would differ based on asking people in more kind of day-to-day level positions, I guess.
Yeah, because you'd think in principle it should be high on the agenda for everyone because that's what they need to be doing. But in reality, it's very different, as we know.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see if they do any follow-up with kind of expanded stats around who they go to. Because like you say, it is very important within the industry where there are so many different moving parts.
And the regional thing. I mean, it's great that it's a global report, don't get me wrong, but the regions are really important. What goes on in Europe is very different. And even within Europe, what's very country by country is very different to what's happening out in the US, to what's happening out in APAC.
Absolutely. More stats, please.
We love stats.
Exactly. Moving on to our third news story of the week. Starling Bank have withdrawn paid advertising from Facebook and Instagram and will continue to boycott both platforms until parent company Meta takes definitive action to eradicate financial scams on the platforms. In her annual letter, Starling CEO Anne Boden declared that the bank can no longer pay to advertise on a platform alongside scammers who are going after the savings of our customers and those of other banks. Last month, Meta revealed that they are working with Tech UK's online fraud steering group and say that they will mandate that all financial services who advertise on their platforms need authorization from the Financial Conduct Authority to do so. The move echoes that made by Google last summer when they announced that they would decline ads from financial service companies without evidence of FCA approval. Boden acknowledged the remedial step made by Google, but maintained that not enough is being done to prevent people from falling victim to online scams. A Meta spokesperson said that the company will continue to invest in new technologies and methods to combat financial fraud ads on the platform. My first question to you guys is, what impact do you think that Starling's impact boycott will have on Meta, both financially and reputationally? Charlotte, let's go to you first on that one.
I think this is so interesting because the speed at which the likes of Meta is growing and has been growing for the last, 10 to 15 years, I wouldn't even know where to start with putting measures in place to keep the whole platform completely brand safe. I think this is a real kind of call out into the industry to be aware of how your campaigns are run, how they're set up. You know, we can go so far from an agency side. And actually, I work on clients that do require quite rigorous restrictions with their targeting because of the nature of the business. That we can go so far as we can from an agency side, but we have to put so much trust in platforms and publishers to deliver our campaigns in brand safe environments. And it's, you know, it's a topic that is always going to be kind of at the forefront because the platforms change so rapidly. They have to show how they're keeping on top of the content that's uploaded to the site, how brands appear around that content, how they're ensuring it's brand safe, whether it's through, you know, third-party verification partners or through their own means. And I think this will encourage other brands and advertisers to look at, to kind of take a deeper look at how their campaigns run across these platforms. Because, you know, it's not just Starling that are going to be boycotting their spend. I do think this could roll out across not just other financial services within that sector, but across a multitude of other sectors. They will really start to take a deeper look into how their campaigns are delivering and the kind of content that they're appearing against.
Emery, what are your initial thoughts on this one?
I think it's really hard. I think, you know, what Charlotte has just outlined there, the lengths in which you've got to go to already, there's only so much you can do. You can only go so far, but then where does the buck stop? Who should be coming involved? Is it a government issue? You talk about, you know, there's a steering group that will mandate X, Y, and Z. What implications are there if this steering group doesn't do something by what frame, time frame? How's it going to come back to them? Who's it going to impact? Is it me? Is it my mum who is not on Facebook, I don't think, but some, you know, a more mature demographic that maybe not as savvy as we are, that are at risk. And what comeback do they have? Who's going to take responsibility? And I'm delighted that Starling are, you know, stepping up and kind of boycotting because something needs to be done. But I just don't know how or when or who can make it accountable. And you can chuck a fine on, I'm sure. Look, we've seen them hit with fines for various things, various data breaches in various countries. Does it really make a difference? What's the time frame in which they're going to do this? And I do appreciate your point as well, Charlotte. They're huge. The growth rate is phenomenal. How can they actually keep on track? But maybe there's something that's put in place. You grow X amount, then you've got to stop and you've got to make sure everything is fit for purpose as best you can. It's not like they're short of cash. It's not like they're short of brains or they can buy in the brains to do this, but what's the priority of their business? Where's the kind of the ethos behind the type of business that they want to run and looking after their subscribers or their users on every level, not just making it a really nice experience and so forth, but actually genuinely looking at it. And then the finance industry is really interesting as well. You know, what role does the FCA play, or should it be playing? Because it's highly regulated, as it should be. But is that being translated onto the different platforms? They just want to be where their customers are, but it needs to be in a safe environment. You know, long gone are the days when you go into a bank. They're now wine bars, right? Most of them. But, you know, the information and the checks and what you used to have to do to open up an account and the validation and so forth, the security was intense, and rightly so. And that needs to be maintained. And how you do that in a brand safe environment, it's challenging. I really, yeah. I'm glad I don't have to deal with it. I just don't want to be robbed. They won't get much, to be fair.
That's always the aim, not to be robbed. But I think you raised two very, very good points there in terms of who is actually accountable here. And I think, like you said, in terms of how, you know, big tech platforms have been previously fined for not necessarily complying with these kind of things, you know, should more kind of legal accountability be brought in on the executives on that front? But then, like you said, who is actually mandating that? Is it governments? Is it these legal financial regulatory authorities? Who does the buck stop with? And I think that's been where a lot of the backlog has previously been. But I think also you raise a good point in how platforms have been, you know, they've grown. They've got ridiculously large revenues, but only now are Google and Facebook saying, oh, you can advertise financial stuff with us if you're approved by the financial regulatory authority. It's just online payments aren't new. How has it taken this long for them to kind of realize that? And I think that's where questions have to be made in terms of big tech platforms. Can they be a bit more proactive with this kind of thing? Every, you know, there's been brand safety crises. They brought in measures to react to that. But I think, you know, they've got the revenues to be a bit more proactive is my point there.
Yeah, but then the danger is that they just put money into a new steering group that they're funding, that, you know, they're just marking their own homework. That's my concern as well. Go ahead, Charlotte.
No, I was just going to say, despite being as digital savvy as I think I am, I actually fell for one of these scams last year. I saw a pirated tweet on Twitter, and it was for a makeup brand that I use all the time. And it said that they had this new range was half price, and I stupidly fell for it, put my card details in, and lost 30 odd pounds. And I thought, gosh, if I'm falling for this and this is my day-to-day job and it looks so authentic, and as you say, Emery, how are other people who don't have that knowledge and don't have that understanding? No wonder people were losing so much money, and there was so much scamming happening over lockdown. You know, someone who spends their life looking at these platforms and spending money with them and setting up campaigns, it's like, if I'm falling for it and this is my job, how on earth are other people going to kind of understand the risks that come with, putting payments through on social platforms, for example. So I think it's, they really do have to step up and start looking at everything that runs through these platforms, really getting measures in place to stop this happening to other people, because it has been a real problem over the last, I mean, even before lockdown and before COVID, scammers were around, but it's really been put under a microscope with obviously more people at home and more people online. So, completely agree. It's not just about ticking one of these boxes and making sure you have measures in place for that. It's essentially that looking at your whole business and how brands work with you and how advertisers work with you, and then how consumers are using that platform as well, to make sure that they're not ultimately coming out shorthanded and losing money out of it. And I've kind of flipped this in my head because we've gone from a brand boycotting it, but I think it's also, you know, protecting the consumer and protecting their users at the same time.
But it is relevant because, you know, that would be the next narrative from another brand in terms of, we're putting your safety and security first. It'll be, you know, I'd be curious. I don't bank with Barclays, but they had their digital gurus campaign, I think, a couple of years ago, trying to teach people to be more digitally savvy, or... and I think it's NatWest at the moment are talking about, you can talk to a person 24/7. You know, you don't need to stay awake and be looking online if you want to get your savings together or get a mortgage or whatever. I don't actually know the detail of the service, but that they're trying to sell. But ultimately, it's that you can talk to a human. And I think this is going to come full circle. And I think people were kind of going, okay, we can deliver it once you're set up to a degree, but come and talk to us, pick up the phone. Or, you know, maybe there will be more kind of pop-up banks opening up where people can go face-to-face and build that connection originally, just from the financial services. Maybe it's probably a load of nonsense. It'll never happen. But it's about not just kind of creating an art, but fulfilling it and putting us at ease and putting every measurement in place. But even in that regards, the scammers are the smartest people out there. They're just, you know, multiplying and multiplying, and there's only, you know, there's only so much they can do. But I just feel that, as we discussed earlier, someone needs to step up and put as stringent procedures in place as possible to protect everybody involved, the banks, the investors, the Joe Blogs, whose, you know, hard-earned cash is going in there, or whatever level that might be. But yeah, what was your question? Do you think that Google and what we know of Meta's plans for tackling fraud will be successful? No.
Yeah, I think they'll get to one point where they've tackled one issue, and then on the back of that, there'll be 17 other issues that they then need to face, and that'll take God knows how long to then find a solution for those.
Yeah, absolutely. Short and succinct way to wrap that one up. Moving into the second part of the podcast, where we find out all about the Seven Stars and what's been going on there. So yeah, Charlotte, over to you.
Yeah, so we've started off this year really well. So obviously the Plan B government news kind of shook us a little bit. We all had just got used to being back in the office. We were doing 3 days a week and then working 2 days remotely, which was great because it kind of gave everyone the opportunity to get together, have face-to-face meetings, which we had all been missing over lockdown. And then Plan B struck and we were back at home. So we've been back working from home since the middle of December. But we've had some really brilliant news from the start of the year. We've won the Cow business, which is the owner of Jumpfrida. So that was a really exciting win for us. And we've had a number of other wins, which are currently under embargo, which I'm sure will be in the trade press very soon. But I think one of the biggest changes within the agency is how we're kind of bringing our activation and planning together. So you may have seen in the trade press that we've been working really closely with Google, and particularly YouTube, in kind of pushing YouTube as a fourth broadcaster, and looking at them as an additional broadcast platform, not just within kind of the digital space, but across the whole of the AV platform. So we've had all of our TV planners, they're all kind of trained up in how to plan YouTube campaigns. So this kind of links back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of not treating channels as silos, and instead looking at AV as every video opportunity across the media plan. So whether that's linear TV, online video, connected TV. So we now have a number of experts within the agency who can plan and buy and build kind of effective campaign strategies across YouTube as a total platform alongside other AV opportunities.
Awesome. And in terms of that, getting the breaking down those silos, has there been any kind of technical challenges to that, or is it just kind of ensuring that the conversation between those different teams is happening?
I think it's really important to be mindful, firstly, of the client needs and making sure that we're not just producing a one-size-fits-all solution for every client. You know, some clients will spend more in digital, and then within that, some are spending more on brand or more on performance. So it's making sure that we can adapt, and we do adapt our approach depending on what it is that client wants to deliver. I think what's really interesting, and as we spoke about earlier, is that kind of how we move to that measurement space and making sure that all of our measurement platforms are working holistically and taking in the nuances of each channel to make sure that we can therefore show results that have been delivered from all of those channels working together, rather than just here's your reach from TV, here's your click-through rate from digital, for example. How are we showing that all of those channels are working together to reach our clients' objectives and deliver against our clients' KPIs?
Absolutely. Sorry, Anne-Marie. I think I spoke across you.
No, it's fine. It's really interesting. I'd love to kind of check back in with you in a few months' time if you're, you know, allowed to talk to us frankly about, in reality, how it's worked out or how it, you know, it continues and the lessons that you guys are learning, because I think our listeners would find that really, really helpful, because I think a lot of people are trying to do it and some people, the nature of the size of their organizations is going to be harder. You guys have always been agile and nimble. It's, you know, Jenny as a leader in the business has always been kind of fairly open about how she wanted to run the business. And that I think is testament to the client wins that you now have that you can and talk about. And the ones that we'll keep an eye out for, which I'm sure will, you know, break on exchange wire first when you talk about trade press.
Yeah, I think so. I've worked at a network agency previously, and I cannot believe the difference in how they operate. And again, it's purely down to the sheer size. You can't make quick changes like you can do at an independent, because there are just so many people involved. And this, you know, these haven't been overnight changes. They've been happening over the last 18 months or so. But I do think lockdown has worked really well for us in making us really evaluate how we work as an agency, what does that agency model look like, and actually how are clients and brands changing their business model, and what can we do to cater to that. And, you know, as I said, it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. And when you look at all of our pitch documents, they're all so vastly different. And it's brilliant because we actually can deliver against what we're promising. It's, you know, if we say we can invest in a data solution that will deliver X, Y, Z, we'll then see it through. And we have brilliant relationships with media owners. You know, we work really closely with Google, as I said, in kind of developing this our activation team and upskilling them in all areas of what we can deliver, not only across digital but every channel. So yeah, it's really exciting. And actually I think this is kind of just the beginning for the big changes we're going to see from the Seven Stars. I think there's definitely plans in place to take that even further and look into new ways of working with clients.
Awesome. Can't wait to hear all about it further down the line.
I'll just have to go back and tell people that are doing it that I promised it on a bookshelf now.
No pressure, guys. No pressure. But it's been promised. That just about draws us out of time, I'm afraid. But Anne-Marie and Charlotte, it's been absolutely great having you on the podcast and great to hear your thoughts.
Thanks for having me. It's been good fun.
Yeah, thanks both. I enjoyed that.
Awesome. And thanks to you all ever so much for listening. That was this week's MedTech Podcast.